Forever.
Welcome to another episode of Best Show Bests, the greatest hits of the best show, with me, your host, Tom Sharpling. If you like what you hear, make sure you join us every Tuesday night on Twitch at 6 p.m. Pacific for a brand new episode of the Best Show, featuring callers, celebrity guests, live music, and plenty of surprises. Enjoy! Hey, Best Show back. Best Show 24-hour marathon. We're about to head into the next hour of this. I think we have 7 hours to go now. And I'm going to go to the phones. I think we have a guest. I'm going to the phones. That's right.
Famous person on the line.
That's right.
Famous person on the line.
Here we go.
That's right. We've got a famous person on the line. And now, everybody, it is my pleasure to welcome to the Best Show, Jarvis Cocker. How are you, Jarvis?
Hello, Tom. I'm all right. How are you if you've been broadcasting for 17 hours straight?
I've been talking for 17 hours straight, and I've never done anything like this. The most I ever talked was 6 hours. I've done 6 hours of shows, and yeah, this is a whole other thing. I didn't realize how low it would get, and it's a real test of my willpower, and it's like me versus me right now. But I think, and right. I think I'm losing. It's me versus me, and I'm losing.
No, don't say that. Don't say that. How much coffee have you drunk?
I've had a bunch, but I've tried to moderate the amount of coffee I have been taking in, because I didn't want to truly crash. So I've been trying to keep it on like a steady, almost like an IV drip, if that makes sense.
Right, yeah.
But I'm doing okay, and you being here makes me very okay. You are obviously, everybody knows who you are. Everybody listens to the show is probably doing backflips right now. Jarvis, you wrote a book that just came out. It's out in it's out in the UK. It's out in Europe. Is it out in the US yet?
No, I think like it's available, on import, and I think we're trying to get a distribution deal for it. But there isn't a publisher in the US now.
Sure. Well, it's an amazing book. It's called Good Pop, Bad Pop, and Inventory by Jarvis Cocker, and this book. What a joy it was to read this book. And you, I guess ostensibly it's you talking about everything up until like the point when pulp kind of pops is where the line stops. But it's such an amazing journey through your thinking and your experiences and everything that made you. And well, first of all, the book just looks beautiful. The design and the photos, everything is just wonderful. I can't recommend the book highly enough. It's just a real a true achievement. And the way you tell your story is by way of the items that you are kind of sorting through and kind of piecing your past together and what has value and what you can say goodbye to. And it's just, you really killed it with this, Jarvis. What an amazing book.
Well, thanks, Tom. Yeah. I mean, it's all down to really the fact that I've never really thrown anything away in my life, which obviously can lead to problems. But all this stuff, like you say, it's kind of a life story told through objects, and all these objects were just in a loft of a house that I used to live in, like about 20 odd years ago. And I'd left this stuff there. I'd left London for a while and just left this stuff in a friend's house.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought that was kind of not so nice of me. Maybe they might want that space for themselves to store their rubbish in rather than my rubbish. So I always thought I would get to grips with it one day, but I guess lots of people have got things hidden away in lofts or cupboards, and you very seldom do get round to doing that. But one day I just decided to do it. And luckily for me, I suppose, instead of throwing it all into what I would call a skip, but you would call a dumpster, you mm-hmm. know, just throwing it all away, I decided to look at each object individually, take pictures, and see if they could tell me a story. And as you say, they've ended up in this book, and it ends up being a life story told through objects, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And how long had you been contemplating writing a book like this? Because there's other things you've written. There was actually a kind of like, what would you call the shorter version of Good Pop, Bad Cop, which was based on two lectures that you had done?
Oh, yeah, well, that's good. You see, now, what happened was, yeah, I came up with that title for, like, we had this thing called Brexit. You've probably
yes,
heard of it
absolutely.
Over there. Terrible idea, but unfortunately it happened. And I was very much against it. I've spent a lot of time living in Europe, so I was very keen to remain part of Europe, but it went the other way. And I did quite a lot of going to on marches and stuff like that. And like you say, I put together two speeches that I'd made, impassioned speeches trying to change people's minds about the subject of Brexit. They were collected in a pamphlet called Good Pop, Bad Pop.
Yeah.
But then when I came to writing the book, I suddenly realized, why did I throw away that great title on a little pamphlet like that? Because I don't know, it just seemed like it would be the best title for this book, because most of the objects that I come across are pop items, because I believe I was kind of raised by the TV and the music that I listened to. I mean, mm-hmm. I've been reading your book, and I've just been reading your bit about auditioning for the New Monkees.
Oh, God.
And obviously, I don't want to raise that, because I know that's not such a nice memory for you.
Oh.
But
it's fine.
Obviously, we share a love for the original Monkees. You know, I watched that program so much when I was a kid, and I think that had a lot to do with my desire to be in a band. I think because I saw it when I was so young,
mm-hmm.
I probably thought it was like a reality TV show, you know?
Yeah, and it's funny that the when you think of the Monkees as this, it's kind of like the Pinocchio story in the real world, where it's this prefabricated band that somehow became a real band against everybody's wishes. No, none of the people on the business side of things, the Don Kirshners and the people who were running the television show, ever wanted the Monkees to play their own instruments, for example. But they did, and they recorded this album, Headquarters, which is this amazing kind of ramshackle garagey album, which is just it's special, and it's kind of, but it sticks out in the catalog as this like sore this nail. It's like a square peg in a round hole, because they had the best session guys, but then suddenly there's this album that feels like very homemade, and it's just the Monkees will always hold a very special place in my heart, because there's something beautiful about the whole concept, because they're basically saying, what is authenticity is ultimately what the Monkees say to me, because at that point the Beatles are singer songwriter. You got to write your own songs if you're legit, if you're authentic. But the Monkees now the time has proven that the songs are the songs, the singing is the singing, and that is what makes something stand the test of time. So yeah, the Monkees are incredibly important to me. So how long had you been thinking about actually writing this sort of book?
Well, I guess a lot of people, you know, you kind of think at the back of your mind, oh, yes, one day I'll write a book. Mm-hmm. I liked the idea of it, but I didn't really... Well, it kind of almost happened by accident. I did a collection of lyrics about 10 years ago, mm-hmm. and that book was taken up by a Spanish publisher and translated into Spanish. And I got to be friends with the woman who had bought the book, and she then became a literary agent, and she said, Jarvis, can I be your literary agent? And I said, well, yes, Monica, you can, but I've no intention of writing a book, but if you think it's a good idea, then I've no objections. So she became my literary agent, and then kind of almost without me realizing, she got me a book deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a good deal. So then I just had to write a book.
Yeah, she took care of the deal part of book deal. You had to take care of the book part of book deal, which is
I was so grateful to her for doing that, because I left to my own devices, I never would have focused myself to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But because she got me this deal, it was just like, well, you've got to do it now, otherwise you're going to look an idiot. And that's often the spur that we need to actually create things, is that fear of shame of being shown up. And in this case, it worked, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's...
But it still took me quite a long time. I mean, I started the book almost 5 years ago, because I had to kind of teach myself to write in a different way. I mean, I don't know if you felt that. I know that you write scripts and things, but, mm-hmm. but writing a book is a different thing. It was much different to writing songs.
It's different than anything I've ever done. And the one of the hardest parts was getting my voice to work on a page without it just feeling like somebody just rolled a tape recorder and transcribed me talking for a couple days and then cobbled that together into a book. Mm. Like trying to make it work as a book, but also have it feel kind of like, it's like, it's getting that ease is the hard part of just about anything. To make something look effortless and breezy is what takes the most effort. And writing a book is the ultimate version of that. At least I thought. I can't think of anything I've done that was harder than writing a book. So you get it. I get it. Now, what a big part of the book is your fascination with the charts, which is much more of a British thing than a US thing in terms of the rooting interest you could have wanting a single to be like the idea of the Christmas number one is something that does not happen here in the US. That's not, but in England, it's this amazing like race to see who can get the Christmas number one single. What are some of the chart battles that throughout your life that you were just really invested in?
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, I get what you're saying. The charts for me have become less important, and I'm often wondering whether that's just because of my age or whether they've just gone rubbish. I prefer to think they've just gone rubbish, but I don't know whether that's actually true. But like you mentioned, the Christmas number one thing, I mean, that's become really dull in this country over the last few years, because there's this guy who has cornered the market. Basically, every year he releases a song with all the proceeds going to charity. So that's the good side of it.
Sure.
But it's always just a cover version of a famous song into which he manages to put the word sausage roll.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with sausage rolls. They're kind of like sausage meat with like flaky pastry around them. They're very popular in the UK. I don't know if they're so popular in the States. Anyway, I think the first one he had was, I love sausage rolls. So that was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And then what? Anyway, he's had the number one for the last 3 years, so I've lost interest in the in the Christmas number one battle.
Well, how about as a kid? Do you remember chart battles as a kid really you were obsessed with?
Another one. Do you really want another one?
Oh, yeah, I'll take as many as you can do, as many sausage roll songs as you've got.
Oh, man. But now I've got to remember. I'm going to have to Google now. Because I try to keep them out of my out of my consciousness. Because,
sure. But when you were a kid, were there certain ones?
Then you always sing that.
Mm-hmm. And you then the original song, you know, song goes away somehow. Song. Yeah. It it's funny because you but
here
you,
we go. Hold on, I've got one for you now.
Okay.
All right, we've got I Love Sausage Rolls.
Okay.
I can give you the sample lyric if you'd like.
Please.
I saw him standing there in the bakery, holding the biggest sausage roll I've ever seen. Don't know it would turn me on, but I'd never seen one. I mean, it's quite rude as well.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's the way he desecrates Joan Jett's song.
Sure.
On that one. Now let's have a look. The year before, no, hold on. Now that was the one in 2019. The one in 2020. That was an original song. Rubbish. Right, last year's. I'm going to find you last year's.
Mm-hmm.
Was. Come and sing and dance to Sausage Rolls with me. Here we go, we are back, trying to make history. I don't know. Anyway, it seems that maybe they only did that one. Maybe they were... anyway, I've shared too much with you there. But the last time that I really took a lot of interest in the charts was probably back in punk times. You know, it was a big thing to think that punk bands could get in the charts.
Sure.
You know, the famous thing in the UK is that when there was the Silver Jubilee, the Sex Pistols released God Save the Queen, and everybody kind of agrees now that that should have been number one, but somehow they fiddled the figures, and I think it was Rod Stewart's Sailing was number one instead.
Sure, the fix was in, and they were not going to let that happen. Now, how did it feel for somebody who was... go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, go on, sorry.
I was going to say you were mindful of pop music, mindful of the charts, and then when your turn came, common people went to number two, right? It didn't go all the way.
Yeah.
You almost had the number one single. And what kept it out was another kind of like garbagey song, right?
Well, that was these two guys called Robson and Jerome who were in a TV program. And they kind of, they also desecrated famous songs. So they did a cover version of Unchained Melody.
Mm-hmm.
And that was number one instead of Common People, yeah.
Sure. And that, it's almost like one of those things where it's like, what are you going to do? What should have been was not what was. It's a number one song in all of our hearts.
Well, the thing was, before that, Pulp, I think the highest we'd been in the charts was like number 30. So to actually get in the top 10 was just like a mind blowing thing. It was, you know, as you say, maybe it's an alien thing in the States. I guess at one point it would have been a big deal. But I guess people gave up on the charts in the States quite a long time ago. I mean, as I say in the book, you know, I kind of realized that a few years ago when I was in Chicago and I was recording an album with Steve Albini, and he's famous for kind of hating chart music and pop music. And we were talking one lunchtime and he asked me what my favorite type of music was. And I said, pop music. And he kind of nearly choked on his sandwich he was eating. So that made me realize that they don't really hold the same thing. I suppose maybe because the UK is a smaller country, and the thing that I liked about the charts, or that seemed to be a thing, that it was a is a kind of weird form of capitalist democracy, because a 7-inch single would cost maybe 50p, you know, which is less than a dollar, whatever. And you could buy that single, and then you would kind of, like, as you said at the beginning, like, you would feel invested in that, like thinking, oh, is that record going to go up the charts? It was almost like betting on a horse or something.
Yeah.
You felt like you had some, you were kind of voting in some kind of exciting election.
Sure.
And if enough of the like-minded people voted for that song, it could get somewhere. And they, I suppose the one that I always seem to use as an example of that was when Laurie Anderson got to number two in the UK pop charts with her song Oh Superman, which was just, you know, something so left field.
Yeah.
Was there almost at number one.
And that is the beauty of the British charts, because the US is just so enormous that you just can't move the needle as easily as you can, because there's just, I mean, the US is just too big to do that. You have so many regional hits in the US over, like, that's been the history of so much rock here. It's just like, oh, this band was popular in Texas, but their records really didn't make it much out of that. Like, there are these local hits. England is just a little more manageable in terms of the charts and actually being able to make a dent, and you have your identity tied to those singles you buy. You know, one thing I was curious about, you've always had, like, movies have always clearly been important to you. You've talked in the past about having kind of filmic aspirations, I guess, over the years. And is that something you still have? I mean, I know you did the Wes Anderson music, which was amazing. You got to do the French pop for that, as was it Tip Top?
And yeah, that's it. Yeah, in Wes Anderson's last film, The French Dispatch, there's this kind of fictional pop star called Tip Top, who doesn't actually appear in the film. But me and the band that I have at the moment, we did a version of a very big French hit called Aline, we did that for the film. And then Wes thought it would be interesting to, like, pretend that Tip Top really existed, and why don't you do his greatest hits album, which was fantastic for me, because I've been a fan of French pop music for a long time. So I could kind of pick a lot of these songs that I really love and try and do good versions of them. So that's what the Tip Top album is. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you still feel, because you've done a book, you've done so much with music, you've done a book, like, film, is that a medium you would want to ever try in any way? Because I know in the past you had talked about wanting to make a go at some kind of thing in movies. I don't know if you were thinking about directing or writing or something like that. Is that still an ambition you have?
I guess so. You know, I mean, that's what made me move to London at the end of the 80s. Pulp had already existed. I mean, I started the band at school, and after school finished, the other members of the band went to be sensible and go to college and university. And I stayed in Sheffield because I really wanted to be, you know, to be a musician and have that as my life. But then it didn't really work out. And I got to kind of my mid-20s and thought, if I don't make a move now, I'm just going to be stuck in this town for the rest of my life.
Sure.
So I applied randomly to St. Martin's College, which some people might be familiar with because of the lyrics to Common People. I applied there to do film. I'd picked up an old Super 8 camera from a kind of, you know, like a garage sale kind of thing. And I'd filmed a couple of things, and I applied to college, and through a strange, I don't know, I got in, and that got me out of Sheffield and got me to London. And so I studied film for 3 years and thought maybe I would do something with that. But then in a weird kind of way, towards the end of college, we played a concert and suddenly people clapped. And so I thought, oh, okay. because music has really always been the thing that I've wanted to do, because it's the thing that moves me the most. I write about that a bit in the book, of this thing called the tingle, mm-hmm. you know, where when you hear a song that you really like, you get this funny kind of buzzy, tingling feeling in your neck and shoulders. And I don't really get that with anything else. You know, I can read a book and I can appreciate it, and I can watch a film and I can think, yeah, that's a good film. But with the song, if I hear a song that I really love, it will actually, it's like it gets inside you and it moves you. You know, there's no way to explain how just hearing something can provoke that kind of physical response. And so that's like a form of magic. And so I always wanted to kind of be involved in music because I wanted to feel that magic, but I also wanted to try and learn how to produce that magic as well.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the things I'm strangely grateful that I don't make music, because then I'm not truly kind of taking the watch apart in the way where I'm trying to figure out. I can still hold on to that part of the magic, and truly there are elements that will always be mysterious to me with music that I'm actually grateful for, because I've done enough writing for TV and these things, and sometimes I watch a show and all I think about is, oh, I wonder how many wonder how they got that location. I wonder how many days they were shooting there, and whether they were shooting at night, if they're doing, you know, they're doing, you know, just like this thinking of the technical side of it. And that kind of, it definitely killed a little bit of the magic of TV for me, was just knowing how the sausage is made. No, not trying to make a reference to your number one hits, your Christmas songs, but it's just that kind of thing. So music is important for me, that I get to kind of still hang on to that. I still don't understand it in the sense of how it's truly put together.
Yeah, and it's the thing. It's a strange, you know, because I've now spent most of my life making music, and it is a weird thing, because I agree. I want to still be moved by it. I don't want to. I'm not particularly technical. I haven't really got a home studio or anything like that, because mm-hmm. I kind of still want it to be exciting to go into a studio, or exciting to go and try and play a song mm-hmm. to the rest of the band and see whether they think it's any good or not.
Sure. And you can still hold on to that excitement?
But then again, you don't want to kind of artificially try and pretend that you're still like... I've still got my punk spirit, because obviously after 40 years of making music, you do develop skills or ways of doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you've definitely played with that in terms of how you did the last Jarvis record of workshopping the stuff live and really trying to find different approaches and different forms of attack to see what the results would be. So
Well, with that, I mean, that it's good that you raised that, because that was such a revelation for me, because I think for anything, any art form, self-consciousness is your biggest enemy. You know, you mm-hmm. have to just kind of get on with it and not think about it too much. And I've certainly at certain points in my career, I've got kind of blocked and not been very productive. And so when we went out on this tour and we started kind of recording stuff as we'd kind of written the songs a bit. It wasn't like we were jamming or improvising. Mm-hmm. I'd written some words and I kind of had vague structures for the songs, but I wasn't sure exactly how the story ended with any of the songs. And we just started playing them and being... Because as soon as you play something to an audience, you play it in a completely different way to how you would play it in a rehearsal room or whatever. Mm-hmm. Because you're aware that they're watching and they may have paid some money to see you, so you'd better give them something worth listening to and worth looking at. So mm-hmm. that was kind of the thing that unlocked those songs. And then we also had the opportunity to record them So we kind of caught the songs. It was almost like catching them as they were born and before you start to mess around too much. And that was a very liberating thing to do.
Yeah. That's really interesting for you to just keep pushing in different ways to see where you go. But you can't deny who you are and who you've been in that process. And look, I've got one more thing. We'll let you get on with your night. You announced a day or so ago, the 2023, you're going to do some Pulp shows. Is that going to be a U.S.? Are you going to do some in the U.S. also? Please?
Well, I'm not trying to be cryptic here, Tom, but we're not sure yet. I mean, we're definitely going to do some shows, and I'm excited about that. And it's been really it's been quite touching, actually, the fact that people also seem, people out there seem to be excited about that.
And, yeah.
I am looking forward to being able to lay those songs on people and, to the best of my ability. We're just trying to work out how it's going to work, where we're going to start, where we're going to go. So I can't really, as I say, I'm not being mysterious. Sure. I just can't really answer that question.
Oh, it makes sense. Fully at the one thing I would say is respectfully, please consider some songs from We Love Life, which I feel like gets short shrift in the body of work. It's so great, and people overlook it.
Thank you. Well, that's just because before I decided whether we were going to try and do this, I thought I'd better listen to the songs. You know, the thing is, I never listen to my own music for pleasure, because that's something. I don't know. You spend so much time making a record and playing it live that I would never listen to it at home.
Yeah.
But because we were thinking about doing some shows, I thought, well, a logical thing would be listen to the songs and see whether you still think they're any good. Mm-hmm. And so I listened to all the Pulp albums one evening, and I came to that one last, obviously, because chronologically, that's the last Pulp album, and I don't know. I enjoyed that record more than I thought, and I think we probably will play a couple of songs from that, because I was kind of pleasantly surprised by that record.
Yeah, no, it's a truly beautiful record, and it gets overlooked, and it would be nice to see it get some love. So.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, the big thing about that record was really that, we ended up working with Scott Walker. He produced that record, and so it will always be special because of that, because he kind of put the lie to that thing. You know, sometimes when people say, don't meet your idols, you'll only be disappointed or whatever. But it was, anybody who knows anything about me as a musician will know how important and central an influence he is on me. And so the fact that we actually got to know him a bit and make a record with him, is just one of the high points in my life. It's, to use your phrase, Tom, what is it? I'm just going to use your phrase here. Mm-hmm. It is, come here, a story of unqualified triumph.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Jarvis, you don't know what that means to me, that you actually have my book. Blows me away. And you are the best, and we all love you. And hopefully you do take the shows to the U.S., and we will see you wherever you are. We will see it. And thank you for making the time and coming on the show. What a thrill.
Well, thanks, Tom. It's been great to talk to you, and keep you've got the finish line in sight now. Mm-hmm. What, you've got like 6.5 hours left to go.
Six and a half hours to go, and we'll get there.
Yeah. Okay.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Jarvis. I appreciate it.
Well, yeah. Good to speak to you.
Of course. Thank you. We will talk to you soon. And thank you again. And have a great night. Okay.
All right. Cheers. Bye.
Well, 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 how about that? Hey, you like apples? Well, how do you like them apples?
The Best Show is produced in partnership with the Forever Dog Podcast Network. The show is hosted by Tom Sharpling and features John Worster, Michael Lisk, Jason Gore, and Pat Byrne. The show is produced and written by Jason Gore, Pat Byrne, Michael Lisk, Brett Davis, John Worster, and Tom Sharpling. The Best Show is executive produced by Tom Sharpling, Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. Co-executive produced by Jason Gore and Pat Byrne, segment producer Michael Lisk. The show is engineered and mastered by Andrew Gleason and Wesley Knapp. Graphic design, video editing, and social media by Brett Davis. Website and technical support by Martine Sellis. And the show is recorded at Forever Dog Studios in Los Angeles. Support The Best Show on Patreon over at patreon.com/thebestshow. And follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at Best Show for Life. That's Best Show 4 Life. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.